I think it's also important to keep in mind how harmful these out-of-pocket costs are for working people. People with high deductibles, we know, go without needed care. They avoid doctors, they avoid the hospitals. In fact, they even avoid the emergency room when they have high severity conditions. So it is an issue of dollars and cents, but it's also an issue of people's health being on the line, people's lives, in fact.
And how do you plan to organize for Medicare for All?
Well, my organization, Physicians for National Health Program, focuses on the medical profession, although we also work to educate the public. But we do focus on the medical profession. There are many other groups that are involved in this fight. National Nurses United, for one, the largest nursing union in the country, many other organizations. This is a big fight, let's be honest. Even though it's a very rational, logical program that we're proposing, we are going up against powerful interests, namely the insurance industry and, to some extent, the pharmaceutical industry.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we'll continue the discussion. Dr. Adam Gaffney, president of Physicians for National Health Program. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. KBOO programming is made possible by cable listener members and support from the Jupiter Hotel, a mid-century Portland Motor Inn turned hotel. Located at 800 East Burnside Street, less than 1 mile from downtown Portland. Now open, the Jupiter Next, an elevated hotel expansion. Booking and more information online at jupiterhotel.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, difference between fascist and Antifa movements in the Trump era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot in Portland. Challenging the Both Sides Narrative is a talk by Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky. This talk will provide an overview of contemporary fascist and anti-fascist movements with a focus on the key differences between them. Again, that's Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, difference between fascist and Antifa movements in the Trump era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the world premiere of Jump, co-produced by Confrontation Theater and the Milagro Theater. The play runs from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Jump is the story of a 20-something who is reeling from the death of her mother. She is looking for solace in a good place to vape, but what she finds is a journey of self-discovery. Again, that's Jump, every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Hopworks Urban Brewery, offering sustainable brews and local food for 10 years, serving the community at three locations: Hopworks Urban Brewery on Southeast Powell Boulevard, Bike Bar on North Williams Avenue, and in Vancouver on Southeast Mill Plain Boulevard. More information online at hopworksbeer.com. It's 5:03. Time for your KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
We'll be right back.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Bev Clarno has been appointed as Oregon's Secretary of State.
Congressional Democrats hold a rally on Obamacare at the Supreme Court.
And in international news, Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika has resigned.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2019. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLam. The Oregon state government has added another woman to their ranks, leaving just one man in a statewide executive office position. Governor Kate Brown announced last week that she is appointing Bev Clarno, a former Speaker of the Oregon House of Representatives, as Secretary of State. This decision follows the death of former Secretary of State Dennis Richardson last month. Clarno, a Republican, will represent Redmond in the House. Governor Brown had previously vowed to appoint a Republican who would not seek re-election, just as she did after her ascension to the governorship in 2015 left an opening for a Democrat in the Secretary of State's office. Clarno said in a statement, quote, "I know there is not a Republican way or a Democrat way to oversee elections. There is only a fair and honest way. I will administer the key functions of this office in a way that will earn the trust and faith of all Oregonians."
Mayor Ted Wheeler has chosen a former Portland Police Association president as his public safety advisor. Robert King, a retired police commander, will advise the mayor's office on issues of public safety. King was with the Portland Police Bureau for 27 years before retiring last year. At the time of his retirement, he was the subject of an internal affairs investigation after he allegedly gave the phone number of a hit-and-run victim to a local pastor who wanted to settle the case privately on behalf of the driver, who was the daughter of a church member. King also has a rocky record on police accountability and systemic racism. While he was president of the Portland Police Association, King fought against then-Mayor Sam Adams' attempt to create a racial profiling committee to evaluate traffic stop data and recommend policies that eliminate discriminatory practices in the PPD. At the time, King infamously and falsely claimed, quote, "Portland police do not engage in racial profiling." King will officially join the mayor's office on April 8th.
A former Multnomah County mental health investigator has filed a whistleblower lawsuit in Multnomah County Circuit Court. Greg Monaco says that he raised concerns about conditions at a new psychiatric facility, the Unity Center, but he was ignored by his superiors. Monaco worked for the Multnomah County Mental Health and Addiction Services Division as a pre-commitment investigator for over 25 years. His job was to evaluate whether patients should be hospitalized, placing him deep inside the workings of the public and private sector mental health systems in the county. In early 2017, with support from OHSU, Providence Health and Services, Kaiser, and Multnomah County, Legacy Health opened a specialized facility called the Unity Center for Behavioral Health. The lawsuit states that Monaco shared his concerns about patient safety at the Unity Center, including at least one death, with his superiors in the Multnomah County Health Department, who reportedly ignored his concerns. Monaco also complained to Steve March, the director of the Unity Center, but rather than addressing those concerns, Unity officials complained to the county that Monaco was causing problems. Eventually, after extensive reporting by the Portland Tribune, which first reported the lawsuit, state officials and later federal officials validated Monaco's concerns. However, according to the lawsuit, Monaco is still forced to take early retirement in July of 2018. Monaco is now seeking $1.1 million in damages. Multnomah County has declined to comment on the lawsuit. However, last week, the county abruptly fired its two top mental health officials, the Director of Addiction and Mental Health Services, Dr. David Hidalgo, and the Director of Mental Health Care Quality, Joan Rice. Monaco's lawsuit and the recent firings come in the midst of allegations that county staff failed to follow up on 1,200 reports of abuse or neglect of residents in mental health facilities.
Congressional Democrats rallied today on the steps of the Supreme Court ahead of a vote on a resolution asking the Department of Justice to reverse its decision to side with a lower court that ruled Obamacare unconstitutional. The symbolic resolution will likely pass the Democratic-controlled House tomorrow, but it will not get a vote in the Republican-controlled Senate. In December, a federal judge in Texas ruled that all of Obamacare is unconstitutional after Congress repealed the penalty for not having health insurance. That ruling is now being appealed by a coalition of Democratic states led by California. Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire, a sponsor of the resolution, said, quote, "We need our Republican colleagues to come to the table and defend their constituents instead of the president. Ensuring the health and safety of the American people should transcend politics."
Tomorrow, the House Energy and Commerce Committee will review the Save the Internet bill. The bill was introduced by Democrats in Congress earlier this month and aims to restore the Obama-era open internet order favoring net neutrality. Evan Greer, Deputy Director of Fight for the Future, a nonprofit focused on ensuring the internet continues to be a place for everyone, spoke to KB reporter Tammy Habtayas to explain tomorrow's vote.
So I'm Evan Greer, and I'm the Deputy Director of Fight for the Future, and want to make sure that folks know that tomorrow the House Energy and Commerce Committee is going to be holding a super important vote on net neutrality. And your listeners probably remember net neutrality is the basic principle that keeps the internet a free and open platform where everyone has a voice. It's the protections that prevent companies like Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T from controlling what we can see and do online, whether that's through throttling, charging extra fees to access certain content, or outright blocking or censoring certain websites or apps or online content. So this is basically the free speech principle of the internet, the First Amendment of the internet that makes the internet into the powerful force that it is for social change and organizing. And again, there is a bill to restore net neutrality, these protections that were stripped by the Trump administration back in 2017. And we have an opportunity to get it back through Congress. There's a bill called the Save the Internet Act, aptly named H.R. 1644. And it would fully restore all of those protections that were removed by the FCC under Ajit Pai. It's coming up for a vote, again, as I said, in the House Energy and Commerce Committee tomorrow. And it's super important that folks call their representatives and tell them that they want this bill passed, but even more importantly, that they don't want it watered down by bad amendments. So the telecom lobbyists have basically recognized at this point that people overwhelmingly support net neutrality, people from across the political spectrum, Democrats, Republicans, independents, doesn't matter. So their strategy to try to sink this bill, rather than stopping it outright, is to fill it full of holes, loopholes, with bad amendments. And that's what we're really concerned about ahead of this vote tomorrow, is that there could be bad amendments added to the bill that would essentially gut the key protections that we so urgently need to restore. So everyone should go to battleforthenet.com. That's battleforthenet.com, where you can easily fill out a form to contact your member of Congress and tell them that you want them to pass the Save the Internet Act and oppose amendments that would weaken it. That's what is so important right now. And we've really seen that that grassroots pressure, those phone calls and emails from constituents to their lawmakers, really does make a difference on this issue. I know it can sometimes feel like we're just shouting into the void and Congress isn't listening to us, but this is one issue where we have been able to force their hand in the past. And if people really come out and go to battle for the net and take action ahead of this vote tomorrow and ahead of a likely vote on the House floor next week, we can get this bill passed and we can restore these key protections that keep the internet a place where everyone has a voice.
That was KBOO reporter Tammy Habteas speaking with Evan Greer, Deputy Director of Fight for the Future. For more information about net neutrality and how you can make your voice heard, visit battleforthenet.com and fightforthefuture.org.
This week, the Portland City Council will be debating an ordinance that would change how landlords screen their tenants. The proposal, from Commissioner Chloe Udaly, makes it harder for landlords to deny a person's rental application based on older criminal convictions. This is the latest move in the effort to reduce the stigma for people who have previously been incarcerated. Currently, Oregon gives landlords broad freedom to refuse to rent to a person based on their criminal history. The proposal would create limits on how landlords can use a wide range of criteria to screen tenants, such as a person's income, credit history, and criminal background. Supporters of the bill argue that although these screening criteria appear neutral, they create barriers to housing targeted at low-income tenants and people of color. The new ordinance would create a threshold criteria for how far back landlords can consider a person's criminal history, 7 years from sentencing for felonies and 3 years from sentencing for misdemeanors. The proposal will be up for debate in the City Council this week. For those who are interested, they will be hearing public testimony concerning the ordinance this Thursday, April 4th at 2 p.m. at Portland City Hall.
Oregon lawmakers are considering removing the alcohol tax and regulations on kombucha. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden and Representative Earl Blumenauer, as well as Republican Representative Greg Walden, have proposed a bill that would do just that. The bill is titled The Keeping Our Manufacturers from Being Unfairly Taxed While Championing Health Act, also known by the acronym kombucha. Kombucha is a fermented tea product that is commonly enjoyed for its supposed health benefits. Currently, it is taxed as an alcoholic beverage due to trace amounts of alcohol, around 0.5%, present in the drink. Supporters of the bill say kombucha should be treated more like yogurt than wine or beer. In addition to lifting taxes, the bill would also increase the allowed amount of alcohol present in kombucha from 0.5% to 1.25%. Wyden introduced the bill 2 years ago, but it did not get a Senate vote. According to Representative Blumenauer, quote, kombucha is one of the fastest growing beverage industries in the world, with an expected economic impact of $1.2 billion by 2020. This legislation is a common sense solution that would lift unnecessary tax burdens and instead support emerging small businesses in Oregon and across the country.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with occasional rain showers and a low of 51 degrees. Tomorrow will be cloudy with showers in the morning and a high of 62 degrees. Today in history, in 1917, Jeanette Pickering Rankin, the first woman ever elected to Congress, takes her seat in the U.S. Capitol as a representative from Montana. During her time, Rankin sponsored legislation to aid women and children and advocated the passage of a federal suffrage amendment. The quote of the day is from Irish-American community organizer and co-founder of the Industrial Workers of the World, Mary Harris Jones, who said, quote, "I am not afraid of the pen or the scaffold or the sword. I will tell the truth wherever I please."
Oregon Governor Kate Brown has called for a new bi-state office to lead design, engineering, and public outreach for a new interstate bridge to replace the aging I-5 span. Brown has stated that the office should be open by the end of this year. Brown wrote a letter to the chair of the Oregon Transportation Commission on March 20th, calling the current bridge, quote, "a seismic risk, a freight bottleneck, a barrier to effective public transportation, and a source of some of the worst gridlock in the nation." Brown said that should Washington approve the joint project office, the state of Oregon must be ready to act by July 1st, and the Transportation Department should begin talks with their counterparts in Washington to begin planning. Currently, the two states share the maintenance cost for the bridge, and some projects have been put by the wayside, like repainting, as it was assumed that a new bridge would be under construction by this time. Washington state lawmakers have already approved $450 million for the new bridge and are expecting Oregon to pay its share in addition to federal grants for the project.
CurrentCast is a daily podcast that highlights issues affecting one of our most precious resources, fresh water. On today's episode, landscaping with native plants can help stabilize the soil and protect water quality.
We're putting down roots on this CurrentCast. Trees and other plants are nature's water purifiers. Their roots prevent erosion, and when it rains, they slow runoff, so it filters into the ground. But when landscaping for clean water, not all plants are equal. Cheryl Nan of Milwaukee Riverkeeper says native species need less water and fertilizer and help stabilize the soil.
The root systems of those plants work really hard for you. Sometimes the root systems of those plants can be two or three times deeper than the above ground plant.
Their roots may be long, but native plants are not short on beauty. Nen says favorites in her region include black-eyed Susans and asters. So even a gorgeous garden can be part of the solution to water pollution. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika has officially resigned from office as of this morning after being in power for 25 years. 82-year-old Bouteflika had been declared by the Algerian army to be incapable of carrying out his duties. 6 years ago, he suffered a stroke and is now seldom seen in public. Demonstrators had taken to the streets over the last 6 weeks to demand the ousting of Bouteflika, and many are also calling for a complete overhaul of the government. As of this time, there is no information about who will take over the presidency. However, the Algerian constitution allows the president of the upper house of government to step in for a period of 90 days while new elections are organized.
Former Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak is due to stand trial today on 42 charges of money laundering, abuse of power, and criminal breach of trust. He may face up to 100 years in prison. In 2009, Razak created a fund called 1MDB to support long-term economic development in Malaysia. Within 10 years, the fund was under investigation in no less than six countries for money laundering and allegations of corruption. According to prosecutors, the former prime minister used his position to obtain over $700 million for the fund and then transferred at least $14 million into his personal bank accounts. In May of last year, voters overwhelmingly turned their backs on him because of the scandal and ousted him in a display of public condemnation. 2 months later, in July of last year, Razak was arrested and authorities seized more than $370 million in cash, jewelry, and watches. Razak continues to deny any wrongdoing, while several other top executives from the 1MDB fund have also been charged in the far-reaching money laundering scandal.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, the Chickasaw Nation governor talks about the 2020 census, and tribal health advocates discuss their work on HIV/AIDS.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Census Bureau hosted Census Day Monday in Washington, D.C. Officials marked 1 year out of when the 2020 survey will begin. The agency has a number of partners and campaigns across the country to encourage people to participate in the census. Efforts are underway to ensure more accurate accounts of tribal communities. Chickasaw Nation Governor Bill Anitubby spoke about U.S. government treaty and trust responsibility and how the census is essential for the allocation of funding. He says tribes can do their part to encourage tribal citizens to participate.
So the Chickasaw Nation has formed a complete count committee for this purpose. And we've launched an awareness campaign that includes an advertising campaign in both tribal and local outlets, direct mail pieces to reach citizens and employees at their homes, encouraging them to participate. We have a heavy online and social media presence, and informational booths and kiosks at facilities and events throughout the year. We encourage all tribal nations to institute their own initiatives.
Officials say the 2010 census undercounted Native Americans, and they hope to improve numbers in 2020. A bill to ban Indian mascots in public schools in Maine passed out of a legislative committee Monday, the Bangor Daily News reports. The bill would prevent schools from using Indian mascots and logos for names or sports teams. It comes after the Skowhegan School Board recently voted to end the use of its Indian mascot. Some community members have vowed to fight to try to keep it. Members of the Penobscot Nation are in support of the bill. The bill passed the Education and Cultural Affairs Committee 7-5. A federal judge recently ruled Oklahoma's Indian arts law violates the U.S. Constitution and is more constrictive than federal Indian arts and crafts law, the Oklahoman reports. The Oklahoma law prohibits art labeling as American Indian if the artist is not from a federally recognized tribe. It was challenged by a member of a state-recognized tribe. Laws are intended to help protect Native art and artists from fake art. Oklahoma's attorney general is reportedly reviewing the decision. Healthcare workers and advocates say there's still much work to be done to combat HIV and AIDS-related stigma in tribal communities. They say efforts include education and advocacy for open dialogue, much like other issues are being talked about more in Indian country, such as missing and murdered Indigenous women. Ann White is with the Albuquerque Area Indian Health Board.
When we talk about HIV, we have to also have the conversations around the factors that may put somebody at risk for HIV. And murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls is one of those issues that is becoming more talked about in our communities. And we have to figure out how we include that into our messaging and into our conversations and into the work that we're doing, because all of those things can play a factor into HIV prevention, as well as harm reduction, domestic violence, intimate partner violence, harm reduction. All of those things are interwoven into HIV work.
White was among healthcare workers and advocates at the Circle of Harmony HIV/AIDS Wellness Conference held last week in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Challenging the Both Sides Narrative. Difference between...
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Kahn, Yasmin Kobanoglu, Emily Gresham-Beamer, and Tammy Habteas. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Liam Delta. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLam. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland. At 9, The Politics of Living takes a look at toxic masculinity, a mathematician, and self-care. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Oregon and beyond. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on the big button marked Donate.
Hello, thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. And for now, listening to Totality of Circumstances, I'm Sam Bowman.
I'm Jasmine Moneymaker.
Welcome back, Jasmine. You've been out of town.
I was here last week.
Well, that's true, I guess.
I've also been out of town, and I have a cold, so I just have to apologize in advance for all the, like, sniffling and mild coughing that you're probably going to hear.
Yeah, but we're all used to that in the springtime. So let's get going here. It is... Totality of Circumstances is the name of this show, is what I meant to say. And we want to just check in before we get into the meat of today's show. We're doing another talker today. We did that last week, too. We talked about the issue of trust in the police last week and sort of community trust and police trusting the community. And a lot of that came out of the... What would you... Not a community survey, but the...
Yeah, I mean, the feedback that the PPB got during the strategic planning process.
Yeah, and so the strategic plan is the police's, the Portland Police Bureau's attempt to come into, I guess, compliance probably isn't the word, but to be...
Somewhat
in compliance with the Obama administration's pillars of 21st century policing.
Right. The be in vogue is what they want.
Yes.
And so they've had the settlement agreement kind of constraining them for the past half a decade, maybe.
A little over, I think. So we'll talk more about the settlement agreement later in today's show, and that's kind of the overarching topic of today's show. But what makes that important is that the strategic plan that the Bureau is working on right now is slated to be kind of a continuation of the settlement agreement's effect on the Portland Police Bureau and its relationship with the citizens of this city. And
I mean, kind of. I think if everybody's playing nice, that's the sort of like version of the story that you're gonna hear. But Assistant Chief Davis has been at all of the strategic planning sessions and all the body cam sessions, and one of the things that he said kind of struck me at one of the community forums, which was, you know, sort of like he didn't even reference the settlement agreement at all. He referenced was a previous strategic plan that they had, you know, a decade ago, and basically saying that, you know, every once in a while you need to throw that out and start fresh. So I don't know how much the Portland Police Bureau views the settlement agreement as something that they need to adhere to past the sign-off.
Yeah, and the sign-off that you reference is this idea that the settlement is going to sunset at some point and won't be necessary anymore. And I guess we should go back and look at a little bit of history because it's easy to get stuck in the present, I think, when talking about the Portland Police's accountability... efforts such as they are.
I mean, it's easy to forget that the desolate meadow that we find ourselves in now is the result of a long trek up a steep mountain.
Yeah, and so I guess we did want to, before we get into the meat of the, you know, the history of the settlement agreement and everything, we want to say a little bit about this show and what we're trying to do here, because you may be wondering why are these two white people talking about policing in Portland for two shows
straight? And why are they so cynical?
So we are working on a history of accountability measures in Portland, and so stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, like one of the things that I've found interesting about looking into the history of that is that it really kind of starts in the late 60s with a whole lot of nothing. And then there's a lot of community action ranging from late 60s style urban riots to lots of community organizing, and a lot of it is based in the old Albina neighborhood, which, you know, stretches from Woodlawn down to I-84, basically, in that kind of corridor along what is now MLK Boulevard, but was Union Avenue. And a lot of the sort of DNA of the current oversight system in Portland, you know, the Citizen Review Committee, which is part of the Independent Police Review, and then now we have the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, all of that can kind of be traced backwards for 40, 50 years or so to the late 60s. And there is very little talk of that history when we're talking about the new measures that the city is trying to implement and that the Portland Police Bureau itself is trying to implement, and that in the case of the settlement, the United States government is trying to force Portland to implement. And I think that a lot of that ignorance of history is sort of by design.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that these processes, just by nature of being very bureaucratic and administrative, are kind of opaque. Like, not because they're not all public meetings, but just because it's really hard to keep your eyes from glazing over and your mind from wandering on your third hour of Robert's Rules of Order or whatever it is that they've done. And I think that, you know, what we've learned by looking at these, at the history of just specifically the civilian oversight of policing in Portland, is that the powers that be, which kind of end up being the city and the Portland Police Bureau and the Portland Police Association, the union, are very good at compartmentalizing things so that it's hard for any real momentum to develop in a lot of these movements. And I think in large part, the community oversight bodies that do exist are put in place specifically to stifle that momentum, to make it so that, okay, you have, you know, justifiable outrage at the things that are happening in your communities. Let's make this all happen in a nice administrative meeting with minutes and regular quarterly reports to the city council and to whoever else, and let's all just be nice and calm and civilized about it, and nobody raise their voices, and everybody just get along. And that strategy, you know, in a lot of ways has been effective at not creating substantive change in the city around policing and how people experience it.
Yeah, and we think that the settlement agreement itself is a great example of that, which the process of having that in place kind of began in around 2010, and there's always been discontent with policing in Portland percolating at or near the surface of, you know, public consciousness, like I said, ever since the 60s, probably way before that. But in 2010, you had the killing of Aaron Campbell in January by Officer Ron Frashauer. Shot Campbell in the back as he was turning away from facing the police outside of an apartment complex in East Portland. And another event that led into the settlement agreement was 4 years before that, was the death in custody of James Chassie, who was tackled to the ground by a couple of Portland police officers, but primarily Chris Humphreys, who, just let's just throw this out there, was the sheriff of Wheeler County for a while, long after the Chassie incident, and long after he, you know, lost his job several years after the Chassie incident with Portland Police. I think it was a lot of community discontent around both racist policing and the treatment of the mentally ill by police and people who were in perceived mental health crises, which applies to both the Chassis and Aaron Campbell events. But there were other shootings, especially in the decade of 2000 to 2010, that played into community discontent around this. There was the killing of Jose Mejia Poot in 2001, Kendra James in 2003, James Jahar Perez in 2004, Chassis in 2006, and there are several other events in there that all play into this sort of movement to hold the Portland police accountable, and eventually led to the Department of Justice getting involved. And this is where we kind of get back to that idea of that sort of divide and conquer idea, you know, because the settlement agreement, if you read it, and it's available on the Portland Police Bureau's website, and I know this is kind of futile, but please read it, because it's very short and numbered and easy to read if you have a stomach for legal language, but it's also pretty boring, so I don't blame you if you don't. But it is tailored, it's specifically framed to focus only on mental health and police response to mental health crises and people who are perceived or known to be mentally ill. Very specifically tailored to that. And that has led, whether by design or otherwise, to a sort of splintering of the response to the settlement agreement. I mean, you have people who are upset that it does not focus on race, which led to a lot of sort of self-correcting in the accountability.
Well, not even I think that it doesn't focus on race, is that it doesn't acknowledge the racism that many Portlanders experience with policing in their communities.
Yeah, and the discussion around that is completely absent from the settlement agreement itself.
And it's, you know, and to get back to that idea of compartmentalization, the people who have been active in this push to bring about change within the Portland Police Bureau keep bringing this discussion of obvious examples of and data that support the reality of racist policing in Portland. They keep bringing that to the table, and they keep being told that, you know, this is not the place for that, because all we're dealing with here is the terms of the settlement agreement. So it's kind of hard to find a place in Portland where that holistic conversation can happen. Because everybody's dealing with kind of their own little chunk of the pie.
Yeah, and when we say there's nowhere in particular to have that conversation, there's nowhere official in particular to have that conversation. There are a lot of community groups doing a lot of valuable work, like Don't Shoot Portland, Critical Resistance, Disarm PSU. There are
Care Not Cops.
Care Not Cops. There are, I would say, I mean, it's been a groundswell for a few years of lots of community action that does not translate into actual official establishment changes.
Well, I think a lot of people are losing their appetite to deal with the process in the way that it's currently available. I mean, I think that anybody watching this process unfold for the last 5 years or even further back would, you know, you wouldn't really be able to fault them for saying that not much has changed, except for the police have gotten better at explaining their side of things.
Explaining their side of things, and also explaining when they feel that their side of things is not being understood by people correctly.
Right.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that, like, we just need to tell our story better.
Uh-huh.
We need to make people understand why we're there. And that understandably falls on a lot of cynical ears.
Right. I mean, people who have been involved, you mentioned, I think you mentioned the Albina Ministerial Alliance for Justice and Police Reform.
I didn't, but I should have.
Who's, you know, one of the organizations that was initially pushing for a Department of Justice investigation. they're not the only one. There are lots of individuals and groups. I mean, Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch and Flying Focus Video Collective is an obvious example.
And the Mental Health Alliance of Portland.
Mental Health Alliance.
Which, speaking of the AMA, they were long ago granted amicus curiae status by Judge Simon, who is the judge who is overseeing the settlement agreement with the city of Portland. And recently in October, there was a status agreement or a status hearing held before Judge Simon in downtown.
In a courthouse down
In a courthouse downtown, overlooking City Hall. And I was at that event. Unfortunately, we weren't allowed to record anything. But at that event, the Disability Rights Oregon and the Mental Health Alliance, the newly formed Mental Health Alliance, were both allowed to sit up at the table with the Albina Ministerial Alliance. And all of the things that I just said are very dry and probably boring, and they matter a great deal because whether we like it or not, that's kind of the highest level in the U.S. government and Oregon government that any of these complaints from the people of Portland have really penetrated.
So we haven't talked about that in a while. Like, what did it feel like in that room? If, like, to take the temperature of it a little bit between sort of the government side, the city attorney, and the, I imagine Outlaw was there.
And
the mayor's, representatives of the mayor's office. Like, what was the, how did it feel, the difference between what the community was bringing to the table and their concerns and what the city was bringing to the table?
Well, so first of all, this hearing was to amend the settlement agreement to allow the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, or
PCEP,
or as Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch, you mentioned, would prefer it to be pronounced PICCEP.
Or PCCEP.
Or just PCCEP, because the acronyms, my God. But,
well, and acronyms can make it hard for people to find information. PCEP is kind of a vague acronym. Like, you could type that into the computer in a bunch of different ways and not find what you were looking for.
Yeah.
Anyway, definitely. I get it.
But the PCEP is a sort of replacement plus a bunch of other stuff for the COAB, or COAB, the Community Oversight Advisory Board, which was specifically set up by the settlement agreement to oversee its implementation, to hear community complaints, to hear community testimony, to give advice on directives and policy to the Bureau from a community perspective. And the COAB burned out pretty spectacularly in 2016, I believe, or by the end of 2016.
Yeah, I think it was by the end of 2016. And I think that most of the people, it's still kind of hard, not having lived here during that time. I came back to Portland in 2016, like late in 2016. It's still, I have to admit, I don't still have a clear picture in my head of exactly what happened to the COAB, although most of the people I've talked to, I would characterize them as saying that the city basically starved them of resources, refused to appoint new members so they couldn't achieve quorum and stuff like that. And now this new PCEP has been brought under the umbrella of the mayor's office, and the mayor, who's also the police commissioner, has final authority over who's appointed and all those things. So it's anyway, back to the settlement agreement.
Oh, but and that gets to a point of, like, what the big difference is that the PCEP is appointed by the mayor's office, whereas the COAB was involved a lot of, like, outreach to community groups who were proposing their own members for...
I thought it was, like, neighborhood associations.
Neighborhood associations, uh-huh. And then a handful of, like, community stakeholder groups. Mm-hmm. And the compliance officer for the compliance officer-community liaison, who I feel like we shouldn't even mention just to avoid throwing another acronym into the mix, but they're known as the COCL. It's a group from Chicago that is professionally oversees things like this.
Mm-hmm.
And they, anyway, I shouldn't get into the COCL right now. But so at
so
in October, in Judge Simon's courthouse, what they were doing was trying to amend the settlement agreement with Judge Simon's approval to allow the PSEP to be the new community board.
And what did folks have to say?
Folks had a lot of things to say. So first of all, Judge Simon is, I don't know, I have been very privileged in my life to not be before a ton of judges. I've been through a few. But I found Judge Simon to be, you know, he's a judge. He's paternalistic, and he is above you literally and figuratively and treats you as such. But that being said, he's a likable character, you know. he said at one point early on in the hearing, like, those of you who are here to see the PSEP get approved, you know, we're probably going to need to look at our calendars later. And, you know,
ooh,
funny stuff like that.
Ooh.
And at the end, and he, long story short, he did not approve the PSEP that day. And in fact, on June 6th, they're going to have another hearing at which he is going to assess the PSEP's, you know,
PSEP ability.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Their PSEP ability. Yeah. But the hearing was very interesting. It was a lot of the community stakeholders we just mentioned, very much represented by specific groups. You know, you have the Disability Rights Oregon, the Mental Health Alliance. You had the AMA there in the form of, you know, Reverends Haynes and Bethel. And you had Dan Handelman there. But I was impressed by the amount of attention that Judge Simon gave to the community commenters, who usually get very short shrift from people like Mayor Ted Wheeler and the rest of the city council.
And the COCL.
And the COCL themselves, the people from Chicago who oversee the settlement agreement. And it was a very... It was surreal for me, partly because I couldn't record, so I was just writing constantly.
Uh-huh.
And it was also, it was very interesting. So the city, the DOJ, and the Portland Police Association, and a representative of the Portland Police Bureau, they all stood up and all called for the amendment to be passed, allowing the PSEP to replace the COAB, because why wouldn't we? You know,
right.
And of course, at that time, the PSEP had just been sworn in at a city council meeting the week before.
Uh-huh.
They had not met. They had maybe had a retreat together and met one another, but they had not met publicly. They hadn't released any reports. We hadn't really heard from any of them individually. Judge Simon, another one of his funny jokes, was saying, like, I wonder if that swearing in last week had anything to do with this hearing today. And everyone kind of chuckled, except for the, you know, city attorney, who kind of frowned meaningfully.
No sense of humor.
Yeah. But the what I took away from that was that the DOJ wants this over with. Like, the settlement agreement... And it helps to look at the actual settlement agreement, because on, you know, paragraph one literally states that this is not an admission of guilt from the city.
Right.
The city has never admitted that it has a pattern or practice of excessive force against people with real or perceived mental illness.
And, I mean, the city being the ultimate boss of the Portland Police Bureau.
Yeah, and again, the settlement is between the DOJ and the city of Portland. And so this is the city, which in theory oversees the Bureau, and that includes the Auditor's Office and IPR and CRC and all those groups.
This isn't the only settlement agreement that came out of that sort of spurt of reform.
No, actually.
You know, after the pillars of 21st century policing. It'll be interesting to see as they all sort of kind of wind to a close. Cleveland had one, and LA, mm-hmm. and
Chicago had
Chicago.
One.
Chicago. And as they all sort of wind down, it'll be interesting to see whether the communities feel like they've had an impact. I mean, I think that our community would, what I've heard from them is the answer would be no here. But I mean, I think that, you know, there's only so much you can do administratively to solve these really fundamentally flawed systems, to repair them without being willing to break things down a little bit.
And I think that one of the big takeaways from the this seven year saga of the settlement agreement is that when you don't take the community's holistic concerns into account, you know, the ways that, you know, racism and mental health and, you know, housing status and poverty all intersect with one another, when you try to divide those things up and deal with them individually, it feels to a lot of people like you're not dealing with anything at all. And I think a lot of that came out at the hearing before Judge Simon last year, and I imagine a lot of it's going to come out on June 6th when there's another hearing in front of him to see if the PSEP is approvable. And honestly, based on what I heard at the last one, it's going to get approved. And
yeah, the bar is pretty low for what we expect of the PSEP. And so they're having the PSEP is having their meeting this month. It's on the 26th or something like that?
The 23rd.
The 23rd.
So that will be on a Tuesday at 5:30, which is also when the show airs, which will... we may be cutting back the instances of this show in a month to twice or once, but
for the summer,
we'll let you know what's going on. And we will definitely be covering the hearing on June 6th, and hopefully we can find some way to record it without going to jail. But
yeah, no, we can't do that. Maybe we can record ourselves talking about it.
There's that, yeah. So, and there's a couple other community events coming up this week.
CRC meeting is tomorrow, but there's no appeal scheduled as far as I know.
Yeah, that's the Citizen Review Committee. And actually, more importantly, in a month from now, exactly a month from now, on May 2nd, a CRC case brought by an appellant that has been working its way through the system since late summer of last year. That's going to be heard before City Council, which is, I think, only the third time that's happened, and the second time since Outlaw has been chief. And so that is going to be... That's a little bit up in the air, I think. I mean, you could make predictions about how the commissioners are going to come down on that, but basically what they'll be doing is deciding whether or not to overturn Chief Outlaw's rulings against this appeal from a citizen on their misconduct complaint.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, it's rare for it to get to the City Council, and the City Council generally does not like to weigh in on these things, so it'll
not
be interesting to see. The other, like, important bit about the Citizen Review Committee is that on April 10th, which is a Wednesday, so the Citizen Review Committee has several work groups, and one of their work groups is crowd control practices. And they've set up this community dialogue, and they're asking the public to come in, and if you've had an experience with policing at protests, they want you to come in and tell you about it. And I'm told there will be tacos. And that's Wednesday the 10th, again, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Smith Memorial Student Union. You can find out more info and see the calendar, date, and all that stuff on the Independent Police Review website.
And, well, before we leave for the week, we just want to say if you have any questions or comments or tips or the inclination to get involved with this show at all, this is definitely a half hour devoted to policing and the community response to policing. So if you are interested, please do get involved. You can email us at totalityradio@gmail.com. That's totalityradio, all one word, @gmail.com. Tell us what you think, and we will grit our teeth and read it.
Yeah, cool.
Thank you so much for listening. I'm Sam Bowman.
I'm Jasmine. Thanks,
and
Liam.
Thank you to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Short Docs on Sunday, April 14th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Mission Theater in Portland. PDX Short Docs is a two-hour program of Portland-related short documentaries created by local filmmakers. This year, there will be several virtual reality short documentaries included in the 6 to 7 p.m. part of the screening. There will also be a Q&A with many of the filmmakers. Again, that's PDX Short Docs on Sunday, April 14th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Mission Theater, 1624 Northwest Gleason Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available